Commissioner, you are live.
All right. Thank you, Daryl. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Calker, meeting on the 12th floor of the Capitol today. It's approximately 1:30. The date is November 6th for an informal discussion today on Northern State Power Company's 2014-15 transmission facility cost recovery rates, case number PU14-644. Little background. This is an ongoing discussion during the rate case. We set up some of this discussion, and specifically, we put this out for a notice of filing, a notice of opportunity for hearing back in October of this year. No one requested a formal hearing, so we're having the informal today. And actually, the comment for formal hearing closes November 12th, so we do have a little bit more time, I guess, that we, if someone asks for a formal hearing, we might come back again and do this. But everything certainly seems in order to get started. I know that the company's got a presentation. We have a lot of questions. But I'll open up my colleagues if they have any comments, and then I'll get rolling on it. Commissioner Christian?
I don't really have any opening comments other than if anybody makes a stumble today, it might cause you to have a formal hearing request. So. Everybody's got to be cautious.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fedorchak?
I don't have any remarks.
You know what? Let's do this to start out with. I know, let's turn it over. I don't know who's doing the case for you guys today. Okay. Maybe one of you could take the lead, and then we'll all go around. Dave, maybe you take it since I know who you are, and get everybody's name on the record here, and then we'll so I can know who we're addressing.
Dave Cedarquist with Xcel Energy.
Okay.
Ann Hoyer with Xcel Energy.
And maybe what you do with Xcel Energy as we go around here.
I'm Director of Revenue Analysis.
Okay.
Allison Archer with Xcel Energy, and I'm Assistant General Counsel.
Thank you, Allison.
Mark Nesbitt, Xcel Energy, North Dakota Principal Manager.
My name is Andrew Sudbury, and I'm a Senior Rate Analyst in the Revenue Analysis Group at Xcel Energy. Okay.
Paul Lehman, I'm Manager of Compliance and Filings for Xcel Energy.
Mark Waylogi, and I'm the Manager of Transmission Planning for the Xcel Energy North System.
Victor Shook, Public Utility Analyst with the PSC.
Mike Diller, Staff.
Jerry Leon with staff.
Okay, perfect. So I think we have everybody on the record, if you will. And I'll ask this question just right up front. Like maybe, and words from our legal, Allison, you're our legal person. Would you offer all this up as your testimony today? Or someone? We need, since it's informal, just to have the company offer it up, and then we'll receive it since there's not an ALJ in an informal. So whether it's the attorney or someone, I just asked you since you were the attorney.
Oh, sure, that I'd offer this up as our testimony in this matter.
Thank you very much, and we'll certainly receive it. Okay, I'll turn it over to Dave. And Kathy is joining us here today from our staff as well, so thank you, Kathy. Dave, I'll turn it over to you and let you...
Well, I just wanted to begin by first thanking Jerry for scheduling us on today's informal hearing. We appreciate the informal hearing venue. It doesn't seem like we use it as much as we used to, but we think it's a good way, a productive way to get you the information you need. We are the sort of the last investor-owned utility in North Dakota to implement a TCR, but we have a lot of experience with it. Paul and Ann and the team that are going to be presenting here have incorporated a very similar type of TCR in Minnesota and South Dakota for, well, more than a year anyway, a couple of years. So without further ado, I'm going to turn over to Paul. He'll start off. We have Mark Waylogi here to talk specifically about some of the projects that are involved, and then Drew will finish up with some of the financial information, how we came up with the rate and that kind of thing. So I'll hand it over to Paul.
Okay. All right. So, as Dave said, we're doing this in with three of us speaking today, each of us addressing a certain part of the transmission cost recovery rider filing that's appropriate to our areas of expertise. And we've had one substitute player. We've brought Drew up to the major leagues here, so he's going to provide the financial side, the revenue requirement side of it. What we filed was a request with, if you would go to the next one, please, with North Dakota Public Utilities Service Commission for recovery of our projects that we had previously brought before you as part of our rate case, and that consisted of 25 projects, and including with those 25 transmission projects, we have our net impact of the MISO tariff through the regional expansion criteria and benefits, also known as RECB. What we came down to after we did all of our analysis was that for the calendar year 2014, we have about $2.1 million in revenue requirements that would result from these 25 transmission projects and the net RECB expenses and revenues. And for 2015, we have about $3.7 million. The combination of those two years would bring about $5.8 million. We filed based on a projection of beginning recovery of those that $5.8 million on October 1st of this year. And when doing so and looking at the amount of sales that we would have over that period of time for the remainder of 2014 and the full 2015, we came up with what rate would be appropriate to charge per kilowatt hour. And we came up with this 0.1994, and using a typical residential customer, that would equate to about $1.50 per month. When we made our filing, we recognized that our guess as to when we'd be able to implement that might not come to fruition. And so we had explicitly said in that filing that if another implementation date were to be what we'd end up with, we would recalculate what that rate would be to reflect the amount of sales that would be involved to recover that $5.8 million. And that's fairly typical when we make a TCR filing, is that we do our best to estimate when we would be implementing that rate. But if things fall out that it's a different date for implementation, we adjust in our final compliance filing as to what that final rate will turn out to be.
Well, I know that we've got a presentation to go through, and so if the questions are deferred to later slides or people, that's fine too. But and I know our staff has their own memo, and they've provided their comments. But could you just kind of walk through give me how those costs generically are put together? If it's $100 in cost, how much is what MISO would be? How much is this? Some breaking that down in some broad percentages of what those costs are comprised of.
We do have sort of the details of the calculation, but I'll give it sort of the high level, and Drew will then talk through the details in a few slides in.
Because what I'm really getting to is, what is it that I can control?
What is it that you can
control? So as you're going through the breakout, what is it that we can control? What's force-fed to us by things that are outside of your control?
When you say we, are you talking in terms of
the commission and also you as Excel? But some of your costs are stuff you have no choice but to try to pass those through.
Well, again, Mark will talk in terms of how we go about planning our transmission system and how our objectives are to maintain safe and reliable service to all of our customers, and therefore that results in the transmission expansion plans that we come up with. There are criteria that are set by the reliability standards that we have to meet. So if you think of that as force, okay, but I think the real answer to that is we have the discretion to come up with what we think is the best transmission system to maintain safe and reliable service. So as long as we're doing a good job at that and meeting the criteria, I think we're taking all that into control to come up with what we believe is the most cost-effective way to maintain that safe and reliable system of transmission for us.
I guess I'm kind of thinking, too, is different things of discussion we've had with Excel about reliability in Fargo. We've asked them to do more for reliability, so we've given more in the rate cases. Is there like a gold, silver, bronze package of what you would be looking for in this transmission recovery that would allow you to do more maintenance or would allow you to do less? How do you get to this number?
Probably a good question.
And that's fine if we get to it later, but that was one of the big overarching questions today that I just wanted to walk through. So
if you'd like Mark to answer it now.
No, I think just keep rolling. Just okay. So if so it's coming up later, that's fine. But
take that into consideration. Okay. Add that into his comments that he has for you. If you would go to the next page. Even though, because we're the third of three IOUs that have put transmission cost recovery riders in before the commission, we understand you're fully aware what transmission cost recovery riders are all about, but we thought it wouldn't hurt to remind all of us about that. It's to recover the capital and operating costs that the utility incurs for new or modified electric transmission facilities that are not reflected in our general rates, that we're allowed to return on investment for the level approved, based on what was last approved in our general rate case, allows recovery of return on CWIP, and that the transmission cost recovery stops once we put those facilities into base rates.
When do you anticipate that would happen, roll these into base rates?
The general rule is that once the facilities are fully in service and that we've completed the project, the next test year that would be a full accounting for that project that's already been placed into service is when we would roll them into base rates.
So what's that date projected for all these projects?
Well, there's a variety of dates for those. So if you look at our filing, we have an exhibit or a schedule in there that shows the schedules for each and every projects we have there.
Some so we're going to roll these in and potentially in sequence, not in do them all at once.
Correct. So if you were to say the next time we bring a filing before you, some of those 25 projects will have gone in service and therefore will have dropped out of the calculation that we would come up with next year. But some of them may not have gone into service and may still be in there. And potentially new projects that aren't in this set of 25 might be added to that string of transmission projects.
Okay.
So if you go to the next slide there. Again, these are the 25 projects that we are talking about, and these are the ones that were addressed as part of the settlement in the rate case. And Mark will talk about these projects and give you some of the more detailed information associated with our transmission projects.
Thanks, Paul. Not part of my formal testimony, but just a personal comment. I do really enjoy coming up to North Dakota. I have a good friend that played 3 years for NDSU, the Bison, so we follow them closely. And
you're just kissing up to the chairman.
I
see right through it, Mark.
Yeah, Brett, my friend Brett, I don't know if he played, but he played on, was on part of three national championship teams. So I'm a big sports fan in general, so I do follow the Bison closely, so it's fun.
Can't hurt, Julie.
It's a sincere remark. So anyway, I wouldn't really describe it as gold, silver, bronze as far as our approach on how we plan our transmission system. as Paul stated, we have a set of standards, NERC standards, that require certain things of us. We have to demonstrate compliance with the NERC standards, and so there are a number of projects. I'll be talking about some of the projects in the North Dakota area, but the projects throughout our system are similar in that what my group does is it looks out 1 to 10 years, and we test our system based on what we know the current loads are today, what we know the loads are projected to be over the coming years, and then we test the system for taking contingencies, like a piece of equipment out of service, then what happens. We take another piece of equipment out of service, and we see then what happens. And then to the extent we find deficiencies like low voltage or an element, the flow on an element would be above its rating. Those are the type of projects that come out of our planning process. And we have several of those in the North Dakota area that I'll comment on today. So let me describe those. And
my question, though, if we said you could have 5% less, you'd have to do something less. If we said you could have 5% more, it would enable you to do more. I'm just always curious how you get to that.
I'm with you. And I think with regard, my thought would be with regard to these projects, we don't have a lot of discretion because almost every project in here is an identified deficiency that we must address.
Okay.
There's some that have discretion, but very few. When I look at the list, maybe one or two have any discretion. The rest of them are needed to demonstrate compliance with NERC standards. So most of these are not in the discretionary category.
And that's what I was trying to get at just in my own viewpoint, that when you come with these, most of these are NERC says do it, and so it's our job to make sure we can do the right things and pass them along so you can get the changes installed or updated.
Right, yep. And I'll comment on, if you have more questions on that after I step through a few, okay, we can talk some more about that. So
would your company do projects that wouldn't be necessary? I mean, under what circumstances would that be recovered generally
They're all necessary, but my point on the NERC standards is we have to demonstrate compliance with the NERC standards. If there's a project that is a good idea because there's a lot of load at risk, for example, if substation trips out of service, a lot of load goes out of service, That may not be a required project, but it's a project that's a really good idea. That would be what I would call it's a reliability project. It's needed to keep the lights on, but we wouldn't necessarily have to do it. And when I look at this list, there's maybe one project in here even that's in that category. The rest of them are required to meet NERC compliance. So it isn't an arbitrary expenditure or anything. It's just do you have to do it or not type differentiation. Almost every project in here is we have to do it type of thing.
Or what? What's the hammer over your head if you don't meet NERC compliance?
It's a $1 million a day fine if you are found to up to $1 million a day fine if you're found not to be doing something that like a deficiency on your system and you don't address it. Tree trimming or if you find a deficiency on your system and you don't address it, you could be subject to that type of thing.
And NERC fines you then, or who's the enforcement agency?
The regional entities, like our in our part of the country, MRO is the regional NERC entity. So they audit us for compliance. And when they audit us, if they find deficiencies that we're aware of that we don't address, they could recommend a fine of up to $1 million a day for every deficiency.
But so, that's the scenario. If you don't get the money from us that you're asking for and you don't do these updates, they fine you and you go back and say they didn't give us the money and then we find our – I mean, it's an interesting dialogue how the transmission gets funded.
It would be challenging, yes. Yeah. That would be challenging. So let me step through a couple slides very quickly just to give an overview. I'll come back to this detailed slide. The next two are just meant to give a context of the NSP transmission system is in five states, but we're part of MISO, so our customers can not only use our transmission facilities, but they can use all other MISO members. And then the next slide is simply a observation that the interconnections are more broadly connected. So, for example, a characteristic of the transmission system like frequency is shared across the whole eastern part of the United States. So those are just slides giving the context that the transmission system is broad in its operation. The next few slides I'm just going to step through quickly because I think people are generally familiar with CapEx facilities.
If you could drop back one slide while we got your expertise in here. With Southwest Power Pool coming into North Dakota, how is that going to change the way this thing looks? It's got to change it. I mean, is it just going to be like fingers inside the green now from the purple? Or
yeah, the thing that would change in that context is the purple Southwest Power Pool boundary will be include some things up in the North Dakota area. So Southwest Power Pool will Southwest Power Pool, instead of being contained down in that particular area, will be in part up in that area. But in this slide where it's demonstrating the interconnection operates together, that'll be exactly the same.
Okay.
But Basin Electric and Western and the IS would be part of Southwest Power Pool. So the map of Southwest Power Pool would be expanded to include part of North Dakota.
Well, the reliability enforcement will still be the same people no matter what, though it's MISO or Southwest Power Pool, right?
Yeah, the MRO has this particular area up in green. They're the enforcement entity. Southwest Power Pool is both a transmission entity like MISO, but they're also a reliability. Southwest Power Pool is a reliability entity. So I don't think they're adjusting. When the WAPA system joins Southwest Power Pool, I don't think they're adjusting who the reliability folks are, but the operations will be integrated into Southwest Power Pool's operations.
So will that affect your cost estimates with them coming in with the new issues and seams, or that these issues will – your costs will all hold no matter what happens with
Correct.
Southwest?
Correct. It's independent of what we're doing,
okay.
The Southwest Power Pool transition.
Because it's affecting MDU big time.
Okay. Yeah, it wouldn't – on our particular – on our filing, that would not have any impact on us. So – the next few slides are just talking about some of the large CapEx lines. Those are, I think people are pretty familiar with them, but 345 kV lines that we're building across long areas, hundreds of miles. So we have summaries of those. I think people generally are familiar with those.
If you forward a few slides, there's a map that basically summarizes the CapEx facilities. So there's one that goes into the Fargo area. We call that the Fargo line. It goes from Monticello up to Fargo, North Dakota. There's a new substation we're building called Bison. And then the Brookings line, the La Crosse line, and then another one. And these are just a subset of the MISO multi-value projects. There's also projects our company's not involved with, like a project that goes out to Ellendale that extends off of the Big Stone end of that line. So these are just the projects that our company's involved with. I just wanted to summarize a couple example projects to give you an idea of the type of things that we're addressing with our projects in here. So the first one I'll comment on is there's something called Scott County 345 KV, just to give you an example of the kind of things we look at. So in the Twin Cities area, there's a substation called Eden Prairie, and Eden Prairie is a 345 to 115 KV substation, and the loading on those transformers is approaching the limit that the transformers can handle. So this Scott County substation is another 345, 115 kV substation we're building in the Twin Cities. When we build that substation, the flows will then split up between the existing Eden Prairie substation and this new substation, and it'll unload those transformers that are approaching their loading limit. So that's the type of deficiency we would identify if the transformer loading got too close to where the limits are. Then we would identify a project to alleviate that. And so the Scott County substation expansion, which will be in service in another year or two, that will unload the transformers at Eden Prairie. It's an example of a type of project.
Then take that extent even farther. Walk me back then how we figure out how much of that the North Dakota ratepayer pays and how you'd calculate all that. Because you're upgrading that for the system.
Correct.
And somehow that benefits Fargo and Minot and Grand Forks. How do you calculate that out?
Because
that's a discretionary piece to me right there. That's one where your cost is fixed, but if I would think more should be paid for by Minnesota than North Dakota, that's one of those that methodology is kind of important.
Yeah, maybe Paul can comment on the calculation methodology.
Yeah, all of the facilities that we're talking about here, all 25 projects, what we do is we look at them as being a benefit to the system. And once they are considered a benefit to the system, we use our methodologies we have in place for assigning costs to each of the jurisdictions.
So no different than a new generation facility.
Correct. So okay. NSP Wisconsin would pick up its share through our coordinating agreement with NSP Wisconsin, and then NSP Minnesota would take its remaining share and split that between North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota. So if you get through all of that, you see first that 85-15 split between Minnesota company picking up 85% of the cost and Wisconsin company picking up 15% of the cost. And once we do that, then we go next and look at how much of the Minnesota company should go to Minnesota customers, North Dakota customers, and South Dakota customers. I believe the number is about 6% now for North Dakota. So of this particular project that Mark just described,
Again, like transmission update in Minot, it probably doesn't reach that threshold to be spread load across your whole system.
Well, all of the transmission improvements, whether it be in Minot or in Fargo or in Sioux Falls or in Minneapolis or in Alexandria or in
there's
Mankato.
No threshold where it's local, only local, like Minot area or North Dakota area?
Well, the transmission cost recovery statutes define as best as possible which facilities are recoverable from which jurisdiction. So you look at the Minnesota statute, the South Dakota statute, and the North Dakota statute, and they all speak in terms of the transmission that's needed for our system. It doesn't distinguish whether one particular part of our system is more benefited or less benefited, but treats the entire system as being you have to have a healthy whole system in order for the system as a whole to work well.
Commissioner, if it's classified generation or transmission, it's 6% to North Dakota, no matter where
okay.
It's located.
Then how do we break the distribution line?
The demand allocator.
Okay.
If you're familiar with. That's
all right.
Where information comes from.
Let me jump to an example in the North Dakota area, just because I thought you might have interest. So Prairie Substation is up by Grand Forks. And at Prairie Substation, we have two existing 230 to 115 kV transformers. And so when we test our system, one of the things we do is we take out an element and then multiple elements, and we see how the system performs. If we lose both of those 230 to 115 kV transformers that exist today at Prairie, we end up in a low voltage situation. And so we're putting a third transformer at Prairie, 230 to 115 kV transformer, and then reconfiguring the substation such that the voltage will still remain at an acceptable level with loss of the two existing 230 to 115 kV transformers. So that's an example in the North Dakota area of a similar type projects that we have a deficiency we're addressing, and then we put a project in place for it. So
did we lose one of those a few years ago, one of those transformers?
You guys should turn your mics on, both of you. If you just, it won't be picked up in the recording either.
So that I just wanted to give a couple examples of the types of projects that we have in the list. Those are, they're all similar in that there's some deficiency that we're looking to address, and then we put a project in place to address that. The other comment I wanted to make, this isn't really necessarily relevant to our filing, but our company has been working with very closely with Basin Electric, WAPA, in the Minot area. We've been doing transmission planning with them, and I just wanted to compliment the other companies and us have been working really well together. It's a good example of utilities that aren't necessarily in the same area, like the WAPA integrated system isn't in MISO, and yet we all came together and we're working together to figure out the correct transmission to build for the Minot area, which probably like next year we'll announce what our plans are. And so it's just a compliment to those other utilities. I think it was a good example. A lot of times it seems like utilities can't get along if they're in different type of groups and that type of thing. And I'm just very impressed with Basin and its Central Power, Basin, Verendry, the local co-op. And we had a really good effort here the last few years working together to figure out the right plans for the Minot area. So that isn't necessarily related to our filing directly, but I'm just very pleased with the cooperation. Oh,
that's where I was leading to, because I know you guys buy power on some contracts that are expiring up there, so you're either going to have to figure out a way to finagle some new contracts or build a bunch more transmission to Minot.
Yeah, we're anticipating some additional transmission expenditures in the Minot area. So,
would you call those a cross-border project?
These particular ones, in the context of cost-sharing, Jerry, or
SPP?
I don't think these ones will be considered reliability, I think, which will be sort of cleanly split. Basin Electric will be building some transmission. NSP will be building some transmission. And so we'll each build our own portions of the upgrades in the area. So that was all I was going to touch at a high level, just to give an example of the types of projects that we're doing. Paul had a comment. I think the next slide in here is about the RECB charges, but Paul had a comment that he wanted to make before we pass it over to Drew.
Yeah, and this just slide shows that the net costs of our being part of the MISO system can go either direction, that in some cases we are seeing a net revenue income to us as a result of our investing in transmission system and other utilities paying us for that, and sometimes it goes the other direction. So when we talk in terms of the additional costs that we put into our transmission cost recovery riders for being part of the MISO tariff, it can go either direction, just a matter of where's the investment stream for us and the other utilities going. But the concept there being much like NSP builds facilities for its transmission system that benefit the entire system of ours, the same idea here is that the owners of MISO invest in the MISO system, and there's benefits that flow in either direction depending on particular relationship of where the cost is being spent and who's responsible for it. So,
well, and that's the larger discussion. Jerry's heavily involved in it, and I'm trying to get more and more involved in the, how MISO sets what they're going to bill you. That's something that you can't control when it gets to you, but we can control through our work through MISO to keep an eye, because those are the costs that I get the most concerned about, that all of a sudden they change the MISO formulas, and all of a sudden you get hooked, and it works its way back to us.
And as you well know, that's a FERC jurisdictional tariff, so you're right. So the standard.
But if we don't wait, if MISO comes in and says, we like this, and North Dakota doesn't, but the rest of MISO does, we find ourselves in that position more than less these days.
Yeah, I guess that I would agree with you that that the voice of North Dakota needs to be heard in those discussions and the approaches that are being dealt with at the MISO and at the FERC level, yes.
I trust one FERC commissioner for sure. Maybe more. No, they're all good people.
Yeah, and just an observation in MISO, too. MISO is going away from cost-sharing on reliability projects, which would be today considered like RECB Schedule 26. That's different than, for example, Southwest Power Pool. Southwest Power Pool has much broader cost allocation, but MISO, and MISO was driven in part by this FERC Order 1000 issue.
Right.
But going forward, the cost-shared projects in MISO would be multi-value projects, which are large projects, and then market efficiency projects. I think there's only been one or two of those in the whole history of MISO, market efficiency projects, which are projects justified by economics, that you put a piece of transmission in place and it lowers the cost for customers such that it's a good idea to put in place. So the Schedule 26 charges in MISO that have accumulated to date will remain, but new projects being broadly shared in the context of Schedule 26 will cease going forward in the MISO footprint.
So reliability projects built in Minot will then be paid for all by North Dakota ratepayers in the future, potentially.
Well, not North Dakota, it's NSP system.
Oh, okay.
NSP system, right, correct.
Yep.
Okay. We still we operate a transmission system.
Oh, I see.
Process.
Okay.
It's just the other utilities in MISO helping pay that portion of it.
Okay, got it.
Would stop.
All right, well, we'll move into the third phase of our presentation here, and if you would go forward one more slide, please. There. And as I said at the beginning, what we've got identified on this slide is what we filed with the commission based on an expectation that we would begin recovery of our costs that we identified, the $5.7 million of revenue requirements beginning October 1st and over the sales that we would see between October 1st and December 31st of 2015, and that's what we got to this rate of 0.1994 and $1.50 per customer. We know that we can't start it on October 1st because October 1st has passed, so we've just done another look at it as if this starts on January 1st. Same amount of money needs to be collected, less sales now because we've got a few less months, three less months of recovery that we're going to spread that $5.721 million over. So necessarily the rate would have to increase to this 0.2505, and now the impact to a typical residential customer would be more like $1.88. So that's what we're looking at as far as our ask of the commission at this point in time is to approve our revenue requirements for 2014 and 2015, the $5.721 million, and recovery of that over the appropriate period of time. And at this point, we believe it's January 1st, maybe December 1st. We could start it to bring that down a little bit lower, but for discussion purposes, we've got the January 1st in front of you. And Drew will provide you some more details on the calculations, the analysis that went into the financials to answer any of those questions you may have.
Would you?
And when,
go ahead.
When would that end?
The way the rate would be structured, it would be in place until we file our next request. So,
what if your next request isn't until after you've already collected the additional 5.721?
Well, what that 5.721 million represents is the revenue requirements for 2014 and 2015 for those 25 projects plus the net RECB costs. Those costs will exist in 2016 and 2017 and 2018, but they will be probably different than the numbers that we've got on paper here, because that will now be a new year, 2016. But so if we didn't change the rate, if we just let the rate keep running, what would happen is there would now be an imbalance, potentially a greater imbalance, between the revenues we're collecting using that rate and our costs in next year, 2016. So that's why it's wise for us to file these on a regular basis to get the true-up taken care of, look at what actually our costs were in 2014 and 2015, look what our actual sales were for 2014 and 2015, see how well we came out in actual collection of revenue to cover costs. If we collected too much, then we can true it up and take that into consideration for the 2016 calendar year. If we didn't collect enough, similarly, we take that into consideration for the 2016 calendar year. But the 2016 revenue requirements are going to be different from either one of these two numbers, the 2.1 or the 3.7.
Yeah.
Do you have just a way that the 25 projects, how many are for new projects and how many are for upgrades to existing projects? Is there a – because that's one of those things when it comes time to explain this to the public, that'll be a question I would ask.
Yeah. Again, we have a schedule in our filing, and what we do is we give a project description where we explain what we're doing and why, and so it defines whether that project that we're talking about is a brand-new project or whether it's an upgrade to existing projects. So, you know, if you have anyone in particular, we can go to it, but that's where
we just find maybe it. For the gurus over here, just when it comes time to put that together, let's put that in there as a paragraph somehow, that this is for X amount of new projects and X amount of existing projects for reliability upgrades.
And if there's any assistance that staff would like from us, we'd be happy to summarize that for them.
It's a split of both. The number of these CapEx lines are all new, and then the Maple River, Red River, 115 kV in Fargo, that's new, and Scott County's new, but then a bunch of them are upgrades to existing, too. So it's a combination.
What if it's halfway through the project? You know, the project is not just, we're not just starting this year. The project is halfway through. Or you just start in for the cost for that year, and where did the other costs go if you're halfway through? Were they already in rate base, or how were they recovered?
Yeah, I'll talk just in general terms. Probably a question that Drew can answer much better. But each project, when we place it into the transmission cost recovery rider, is done so based on a date of eligibility. And there are some clear, in some cases, some very clear delineations of when that project becomes available. Because this is the first set of projects we've put in, there's probably, well, I know there's a combination of those projects. So all of these projects, I believe all of them are under construction already, mm-hmm. or very near to being under construction. So they will have become, or being dollars being spent on them up to a certain point in time. But we declared the projects eligible for inclusion in the transmission cost recovery rider based on the date of the settlement. Was that on the rate case? I believe that was the date. So that became our eligibility date. So any costs before that were treated differently than any costs after that.
Okay. So how were they treated differently? Like, give me an example of how.
All of the, as part of the rate case settlement, we credited, included in base rates, components of the projects okay. that had been placed in service prior to the conclusion of the test year, which was 2013. And so we credit that amount from the retail revenue requirements in the rider.
Okay. And Jerry, you've gone through all those with the fine tooth comb to make sure they...
I've looked through... If you look in my memo, it refers to an attachment 14,
yep.
and that was in the rate case as Exhibit Q, and it goes through and says what portion of each of those projects was in base rates when we did the rate case settlement. So that's been the extent of my review,
yep.
is just to
verify
that they're out.
So it's from the point... From that point on, that you're putting those projects into this rider?
Correct.
Okay. Cool.
Move forward one slide. So I thought it'd just be helpful to talk a little bit about the rider mechanics and also a little bit about what makes up our $5.8 million revenue requirement request, just to give some background. So at a high level, the purpose of a tracker is, from an accounting standpoint, to track costs, to set aside costs for review by the commission at a later time. And then another one of the features of a rate rider, and particularly this rider, is that it has an inherent true-up mechanism. And so although we're setting on a prospective basis a rate to collect costs or to collect revenues for these project costs, we compare the actual cost in the rider tracker to the actual revenues that are generated by the rate factor. And the difference between these two is what's known as an over-collection or an under-collection. And then on a monthly basis, these balances get deferred out and are carried forward from year to year and included in the future year as a revenue requirement that needs to be recovered, either returned to customers if an over-collection occurred. And so the advantage of a mechanism like this are customers end up only being billed for the actual cost of the program. So particular in this slide shows what our original filing request was. You can see in 2014 our revenue requirements were around, and this is the North Dakota jurisdictional share of the revenue requirements, were $2.1 million. And if we had implemented a rate on October 1st using a 15-month sales basis, we would have generated potentially $1.2 million of revenue. So this under collection would then be included in 2015 as a revenue requirement. And included, and I just should point out the three primary pieces of our revenue requirement are the transmission revenue requirements, which are the project revenue requirements for the projects that are eligible under the statute, the net MISO credits, which a majority of that is the RECB Schedule 26A costs, and as we kind of talked about before, we're crediting to the revenue requirements an amount that we've already included in base rates for recovery. And so the $3.7 million of revenue requirements in 2015 gets added to the $900,000 that was a revenue shortfall from the year before. And then given the remaining 12 months in 2015, the rate would generate around $4.6 million. So on a forecast basis, you would theoretically have a zero balance. Now, we know, at least in all the years I've worked in riders, never had a zero balance. You know, sales vary. The actual revenue requirements, depending on forecast capital spend, may change. So there will inherently be a balance at the end of 2015. And what would happen is that would be included as a revenue requirement in 2016. And we would seek to either return or recover that amount in our 2016 rate factor, which would be included in our request next fall, I presume, which would be kind of our annual time to file a TCR rider. So that's
we're basically didn't collect anything in 2014, so all of that will be collected in 1 year, 2015.
Right. So if you turn to the next page, just to show what would realistically happen if we were able to get a rate approved and implemented by January 1st using a reduced 12-month sales basis in 2015, we would collect that entire revenue stream in 2015, which again, from a kind of a prospective basis, we would aim to have no balance by the end of the year. Going to the next.
So delay on our end?
Pardon me?
The delay in implementation, missing the October date, was that on our end?
I'm not entirely sure if
we just filed it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we filed July.
I think it's worth also mentioning here, too, that, you know, our original plan when we filed the rate case back in 2012 was that the rate case would be completed sometime in 2013, and then we would immediately follow up with a TCR filing in the fall of 2013 for 2014. But because the case lasted longer, didn't actually get resolved until well into 2014, we found ourselves filing, you know, a TCR where we had to kind of catch up. But as far as the October 1 date, no, I don't think that, you know, we were optimistic when we filed, obviously, and, you know.
Well, you filed the end of July, and so I don't know what's a reasonable calculation on your end for how long you should wait, but I don't really like coming back and adjusting and then shoving it all that extra onto I mean, 150 is more than or less than 188 for customers. So I just think it's better to get the stuff done and get it implemented on, you know, on time. So whether it's your end, being more realistic about the filing dates and how long it takes to process and getting it, you know, true on that end, or if it's our needing to be, you know, on it more and getting the hearing set and stuff. So it's probably a combination.
I'm sorry. Presumably from here on out, we'll be on a more regular schedule where we'll be filing for an annual period of time. It won't be this doubling or whatever. And you know, we'll get on a good schedule. So
yeah, and I would characterize it that there's no one at fault, if you will. This is the third state that we've begun a transmission cost recovery rider. And every first time through, it takes a little more work to make sure that we get it right in filing the information that is needed to be reviewed, that staff understands what we've given them, and they know to ask us the right questions to get the information they need to be comfortable with what we provided is meeting the threshold of proving that we have this. And so it's not out of the norm, shall we say. What experience we had in Minnesota and in South Dakota is that first one took more time than what we had envisioned, and the second one got better, and by the time we get to the third one, we're into more of a routine, and everybody now knows what the information we have to provide is, what the form we have to provide it in, what the staff knows to look for, and what the questions that if we haven't answered in the filing posed to us to make sure that we've covered all the bases, and the schedules of getting it done can be more timely. So I wouldn't place anybody at fault. It looks like that's the typical approach, is that we need to make sure we understand what we're doing.
Fair enough.
Okay, moving on to the next slide. This chart just displays the individual components making up the $5.8 million of revenue requirement, and you can kind of get a feel for how these different pieces line up. Starting on the left with booked appreciation, for the 2 years, it's around $1.4 million. And from the company's perspective, this is just the return of the investment. And depreciation starts when the asset does get placed into service, and then it gets depreciated according to the depreciable service life and salvage values. We're also getting a debt return and equity return on rate base. And this is based on the company's capital structure approved in the last filing, which the total rate of return was around 7.6% with a return on equity of 10%. And this does include a return on CWIP or a return on our construction expenditures. And this just allows the company to recover its finance-related cost associated with this construction on a current basis rather than waiting until the asset gets placed into service. And taxes are about $4.5 million of the total. And this, the rate factor generates revenues that we'll pay state and federal taxes on. And property taxes are also included, and that's just a function of the planned investment from the year before. And also deferred taxes, which normalize book accounting and IRS tax payment, tax timing differences. That arises from accelerated depreciation or bonus tax. And the MISO credits, as we've touched a little bit upon, are mostly comprised of the REC-B charges from MISO, from the MISO tariff. The company incurs charges from MISO for portions of investment that other utilities have made. And similarly, other utilities are, the company receives revenue from portions of investment it makes that is effectively used by other utilities in the system. And I'll just point out that the large credit that we're seeing right now has mostly to do with the Schedule 26A charge for multi-value projects, and in particular CapEx Brookings. Since there are not currently a lot of these projects in existence currently, the company is seeing a large stream of revenue coming in, since this gets billed out to the entire MISO footprint and not just the NSP system. And I think the important thing to know is over time, this largely depends on what MPP projects come online and which player in the MISO footprint is assigned to build them. So this, I guess the point I'm trying to make is this may not always be a credit, but currently right now it's a large reduction to our revenue requirements due to the substantial investment in the CapEx Brookings project. Last piece is the amount that we're currently collecting in base rates. That's around $3.6 million. And again, as part of the settlement in the rate case, we've left in base rates pieces of projects that were placed in service prior to the conclusion of the base year because their revenue requirements are defined and known for the remaining life of the project. And so we excluded these projects from our rider removal that we removed from our base rate request. And so the amounts get credited to the rider, so there's no possibility of any kind of double recovery occurring. So I think that's...
just a general question. If during rate cases, if we give you a larger return on equity, does that mean you'll have a lower cost than transmission riders? Am I reading that the right way?
And you're talking about the retail return on equity?
Yeah.
Is there going to be a lower cost if we have a higher ROE? No, it would be a higher revenue requirement because the company would be earning more on the investment as a whole.
And I might just...
I was trying to get your correlation when you were talking about return on equity. So you're saying that it's better for us to give you a lower return on equity for transmission costs? You just said it higher wasn't better.
Well, I think I'll just say is this is supposed to reflect what our actual cost of raising equity and debt is, and I think how the statute's laid out is we use what was approved in the last rate case, which reflects all of the metrics that were reviewed in the rate case, and so this should accurately reflect what our cost is to compensate investors.
To you until today, so that's very helpful.
So what you're saying, what you're illustrating, is the return on equity shows up many times.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's always what your return is whenever you're constructing or using, getting debt. That's your return on that, and we see it recovered throughout.
Right. It's essentially a way to compensate investors for providing us liquidity to invest in these different various projects.
And the depreciation schedule, each one has got to be a different life, I'm sure.
It does. We have a three different sort of asset classes. One is lines, one is substations, and one is land. And they each have a different... Actually, land's not depreciated, sorry. So lines and substations each have a different depreciation life that, to the best of my recollection, is also rates that are defined in the settlement in a rate case.
I might just add, too, getting back to Commissioner Fedorchak's question before about what if a project is sort of half done. If a project begins, say, in the middle of the year and isn't completed by the end of the year, there's still a transmission cost rider requirement. It's the return on that construction but it doesn't have a book depreciation piece. It wouldn't have perhaps a property tax component. So. Mm-hmm. So whether a project is half done or not, it's still going to create or generate a CR cost.
Okay. So that concludes the prepared presentation we have here for you. If you have further questions, we're happy to answer them.
Before I turn it over to staff for their memo, see if Randy or Julie had any other questions.
I don't think so. Okay. I think you guys laid it out well.
Okay. All right, whoever over here wants to go through your memo.
I'll do that, and it's pretty self-explanatory. I don't know that we need to go all through everything except maybe the recommendation parts. And when I put this together, I recommended that we go with the higher rate to make up for those last few months. And my reasoning for that is that the balancing account that runs, you really would like to zero that out over the period that it's running through so that next time when we have this thing, we don't have a previous balance that we start with. And but as I was thinking about this last night, I was thinking, We issued a notice on this case, and the notice had the first number in it. Is the notice said nothing about a higher rate at 0.2505. And so if legal comes back and tells me that we need to issue the notice all over again if we're going to use the higher number, I wouldn't object to using the lower number if we didn't want to go through that process of issuing the notice.
Would there be enough time to get it done in time to...
It'd be tight.
January 1st implementation?
Yeah, it would be tight. I think it could be done if you got it on the next agenda and ran a minimum notice period, and then we'd be approving it sometime in December. So if that's enough time for the company to implement it the 1st of January, it's a tight thing to do.
Well, I thought there didn't you say that there was a possibility that you could start it on December 1st instead of January 1st?
Yes. If we have an order from the commission in hand by about a week before the start of December 1st, we've been able to do that. We just basically get our systems in place and ready, and as soon as that order is in hand, I think we've done it as short as 3 days in advance. So, but about a week in advance of the change, we can put the rate into effect. When we put our assumptions down here, we weren't trying to push the commission any time frame.
There'd be plenty of time yet to get it done and implemented by January 1st.
If we have an order in December, hopefully, since December is a very hectic month, by mid-December, but also if we got it by the last week of December, we should be able to put that into effect January 1st, yes.
So if we just did this without using the higher rate and they started billing at the 1st of December, we'd have another month's worth of sales volumes to reduce the amount of deficit in the balancing account, and that would put us doing this on the November 20th agenda, which is entirely doable.
So what you're saying, Jerry, is let's just say hypothetically you approve the 150 and then they would refile for the changes of the different 38 cents, but it wouldn't be 38 cents, it'd be something different.
They just roll that into their next year's application. There'd be two.
It would. It gets a carrying charge in the balancing account is one of the reasons not to. Yeah. But like I say, we'd have another month's worth of volumes from what they had projected here.
But they wouldn't alter that. That rate would stay for the year, and then you'd whatever deficit there was at the end of the year, that would be recovered then in the 2016 rates, correct?
If I would maybe point you to, just to give you some numbers to look at, if you go to slide 16 in the document that we presented to you, this gives you a sense of how much revenue in 2014 we expected to collect if the rate had gone into effect October 1st, the 1.167 number down there. If we get none of that yet in December, in 2014, that's what the tracker balance at the end of 2014 is going to look like, 1.167 of deficiency that will be rolled over into 2015 or somewhere in that neighborhood. Although I see that we also already had it, so it looks like it's closer to $2 million will roll over into 2015. The $900 that was already rolling, plus the $1.1 of revenue we didn't collect, so about $2 million it looks like we're rolling to. So that's what we're talking about here of amount that would be carried over, but the amount we just simply won't be collecting is that 1.167.
And that would roll over to, if we didn't adjust the rate to the higher amount, to 188, or I'm not using your kilowatt hour, to the average customer, 188.
Yep.
If we didn't do that and went with 150 for the year, then that 1.1 million, 1.1167 would roll to 2016.
Correct.
Or you could take off a third of it and collect 1 month, and then two-thirds would roll over to the...
Right.
So, or we could do the notice and change the amount and file it at the end of December and, approve it and get it started in January.
So it would kind of be up to the company to file a tariff revision if they wanted to go with the the higher rate. They haven't filed that yet.
But we're kind of getting into the work session discussion now. I think that the point is you gave us a memo here, and we've got to have you clarify with Alana what we can, if we can't, I mean, what we can and can't do with the announcement.
Yep.
And I think that'll give, if it's the way it is, then that'll drive a lot of discussion. But maybe if Randy and Julie are okay, maybe as soon as we get done with the informal, we could do a quick schedule, a quick work session on this. Since we just did the meeting, it'll be two more weeks that we schedule. If that's okay.
And I have to be out by 3.
So. Yep, okay, well, fair enough. So, Jerry, do you have anything else in the memo?
No, that's it. That was all I had.
You queued up a lot for the discussion, for sure.
Jerry, can you just, I don't want to shortchange the discussion component. Can you just go through that? I didn't have time to go back and look at Appendix 1 and, you know, Attachment 11 and all of that. So just walk through that, sure, if you don't mind.
I'll look down at the last couple of paragraphs where I, is that what you're talking about?
Right, the discussion part.
Appendix 1 just details what each of the projects is and tells why it's needed. And then Appendix 2 gives you a status report on the projects, date expected in service, and things like that, kind of in a table form. And so those two appendixes will give you, should answer any questions you have about any individual projects. As you go down, the attachment 4 gives a cost tracker summary for each project, so you can add those all up and see what the end results are. You'll also see in that one where they credited out the money that was already in rate base before. Attachment 5 and 6 give you the summation for 2014 and 2015 costs of 3.7 or 2.1 and 3.7 million. And okay, there's also an attachment 11 that'll detail out the MISO charges. Schedule 26 charges are for reliability projects that were cost shared. And as Mark said, that's going away. The reason that's going away had to do with the right of first refusal. And FERC saying that you're going to have to bid out construction of these projects if you share the costs between the different utilities. And so MISO filed something and said we're not going to share costs anymore. And they're still doing the right of first they're still doing the bidding thing, but not on the reliability projects, if I'm remembering this right. And the 26A was the MVP projects, and that would be where the Brookings line came in. And as you, just to reinforce, that number is actually a credit right now. It's a pretty nice credit, and onto this about $3 million worth, coming from from the investment that was made in that Brookings line mainly, and the return that comes back from the other companies paying NSP as a builder of the line. To get sidetracked, that's part of the reason why everybody wants to build these projects. So I think that kind of summarizes the memo in a little more. But did I answer your questions?
It does. The piece I'm most concerned about is the attachment 14, the stuff that we went through in the settlement agreement and said these projects are kind of excluded, or these costs. So you've gone through to confirm that list, so there, you know, to double check that there's an over and double recovery.
Well, yeah, because it's the same exhibit that was in the
spelled rate. It all out in the rate case, and
yeah,
it matches the
yeah And so it was the same piece of paper that we had in the rate case is attached to this one. So there's been no changes.
I don't have any other questions.
Okay.
Thanks, Jerry.
Mike, you got something to throw in there? What that look
I'm
like?
I like it when Jerry talks because I learn stuff, and I was just wondering why do people want to build to get credits? I mean, it costs money to build. There's a lot of investment. Is it because FERC's ROE is higher than what we grant? Is that the reason?
Yeah. If I'm remembering right, on FERC's ROE, there was a 12.5% ROE or something on that, which is a pretty nice return. I think there's a proceeding going on right now, too, where there's a 50 basis point increase in that or something that's being contested. Mm-hmm. We're just going to have a hearing on it. But, basically it's a nice return.
And I would just reemphasize that, as Drew said, that exactly that is the case. And that's why, as Drew said, there's a nice chunk of money coming back to our retail customers for our investment in the MVP project.
Well, somebody's got to be incentivized to build stuff. You'd be like Texas where nobody's building nothing.
That is correct. That's why I believe that was set at that rate.
Yeah, okay. Okay, anything else, Julie?
Nope.
Randy?
No.
Maybe if we've, while we're still in the informal, we could do a quick, see if we can get the three of us corralled for a work session on this the next week or so. Have a schedule
Well,
with
I'm
you?
Gone next week.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm gone from 3 o'clock until a week from Monday.
So let's do this then. Real quick, when do you get back again, Julie?
The 17th.
So let's do this. I'll work with Jerry on some dates to do that. But I think if I could just give my thoughts out loud is that, you know, I'm comfortable with that we'll figure out some kind of rider here. It's just let's clarify, Jerry, if you could, what the legal situation here is. And then if the legal situation is we're fine with just we can make this modification under this, then maybe we do swing for the whole thing. If we can't, then we'll have to be deciding. I think I can see just two different paths there pretty quickly once you see that out. So that'd be my closing comments. Julie, anything?
Yep.
Randy?
Well, just the one thing, if it was the appropriate thing to do to not carry some of this over from 15 into 16, if it was appropriate originally to get it all bundled in from October of this year through 15, now just because it would cause us to have to do a new notice and to move things along quickly in December in order to do that, it doesn't seem like it's suddenly is the right thing to do to push some off from 15 into 16 just because it requires a new notice.
Sure.
So I don't know. It seems like either it's the right thing to do or not.
Okay.
And we can get a special meeting easy
Absolutely.
Enough if necessary to get the notice approved and out. So.
Well, then I think I just heard that if this covers us, great. If it doesn't, let's get a new notice out there quickly is what I think I just heard. So, okay, anything for the company one more last time? All right.
Just to conclude that we very much appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you, and if there is anything more we need to provide or any more filings we need to make in order to make things work out, we'll be happy to do so.
All right, thank you. All right, we'll go ahead and close the informal. Thank you. Boom.